The State of Commerce Experience podcast is brought to you by Bloomreach, the leader in digital commerce experience. Bloomreach provides solutions for leading businesses all across the world to both drive increased revenue and also to help them personalize the shopping experience for their customers across all of their digital channels. If you'd like to find out more, please visit bloomreach.com.
Welcome, everyone, to the State of Commerce Experience. My name is Brian Walker, and once again, it's great to have you here. Today, I'm very excited to be joined by Ari Greenberg, Chief Commercial Officer at Brightline Trains, the only provider of modern, eco-friendly, high-speed rail service in America. Prior to joining Brightline, Ari was president and founder of BCV, a social media marketing enablement platform for the hospitality industry. Under his leadership, BCV was used by hotels operating under the Marriott, Hilton, Hyatt, and Four Seasons brands to engage travelers via social media. And interestingly, before BCV, Ari spent the first part of his career working with governments in Africa to build better constituent services and secure voting access for a more representative democracy. He also serves as an investor and advisor to a number of startups in the climate and health sectors. When I set out to create this podcast, something that I really hoped to explore was the ways that the commerce experience differs across industries and is also similar. I was also really looking forward to speaking with Ari about commerce and digital marketing within the world of transportation, an area we really haven't delved into that much. I really enjoyed the discussion about the ways in which Brightline is seeking to meet the needs of today's commuter and leisure traveler and how they're working to get people out of their cars to use a more relaxing and sustainable form of travel. Full disclosure, Ari and Brightline are a customer of Bloomreach's, using our engagement products to create a single view of their customers and market more effectively to them, although we don't really get into that here. I really enjoyed my chat with Ari. I hope you do as well.
Ari, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks. It's great to be here. Looking forward to it.
Ari, I'm going to start with the first question we ask every guest. And that is, what was the first job or assignment where you dealt with digital or e-commerce?
So I'm actually going to answer in a way I think is most interesting, but you feel free to say that wasn't correct. So the first time where I felt like I needed somebody to buy something or take an action online was actually very early in my career in Africa, where we were trying to, to build a greater sense of democracy and voter participation in Kenya. And wow. To do so, we were using Facebook. This was back when like Facebook had like widgets and like
what event. Year would that have been?
Roughly? Yeah, this is 2008. So like, Facebook had like widgets and event platforms, all this like other stuff that I think has gone away. But basically, it was kind of like, the I voted sticker, but it was digitally. It was like a commitment to vote where you verified your polling place. And that was like my first effort of like being like, how can we use digital to get a better awareness and distribution and get people to take an action. So we weren't necessarily getting someone to buy something, but we were getting them to take a pretty significant action. And it had a high barrier to entry and not a lot of people knew exactly what voting was and voting participation. So, it was important. And that was kind of like that kind of 2008, 2010, and just kind of seeing the way social in particular, kind of started moving the needle around both online communities and online transactions was, I think, pretty powerful.
Super interesting. Well, Ari, I'm not sure how many of our listeners, especially our international listeners, are familiar with Brightline Trains. If you're not living in Southern Florida, you may not have really encountered Brightline. And so I'm wondering if you wouldn't mind maybe just, starting out by helping us understand. Who is Brightline Trains and what are you trying to do?
I'd love to. So you're going to have to cut me off because I'm a huge promoter. I'm not only a fan, but I'm also a customer, right? So, to me, Brightline Trains is the first and only privately funded high-speed rail company in Florida, currently operating on what we call the small South segment. If you're familiar with South Florida, Miami, Fort Lauderdale, and West Palm are three independent cities that make up about a 6 million megalopolis type of place. Mm-hmm. And they have been connected with a pretty underutilized rail corridor that didn't go downtown to downtown. And Brightline goes downtown to downtown, Miami, Fort Lauderdale, West Palm, and is 65% of the way completed to Orlando. And once we connect kind of South and Central Florida, we're really connecting two of the five fastest growing regions in the country that traditionally have not had a lot of good rail opportunities, right? Or anything really outside of the car. I think it's a great first corridor for America to see what private high-speed rail can do, certainly at comparable or exceeding the standards of Europe and Asia. Got an awesome product, right? It's a very high-end product. It's a comfortable product, great Wi-Fi, great food and beverage on board. You know, we really are designing it to bring people back, right? To make it really hard for them to be like, well, why would I get back in my car when I just did that? Why would I take a flight when I just did that? So that's the big deal. We obviously want to extend that from Orlando to Tampa, right? So we kind of have a very exciting, call it 5-year plan where we're getting to Orlando and then opening Tampa with a stop at Walt Disney World, which is great. And we're also using that to build enthusiasm and support for our LA to Vegas line, which is Brightline West. Wow. You know, if you had to kind of draw a map or pick the lines that you'd most think high-speed rail could be most successful, I think you'd probably pick the Northeast Corridor, right, where Amtrak runs with DC to Boston. Then you'd probably pick LA to San Francisco, California High Speed Rail is building it. And then you do LA to Vegas and Miami to Orlando. So I think, you know, I would like to think that we are going to bring the first privately funded high speed rail to the country. And I think that's going to create a real test case and enthusiasm for Brightline to be in more places. So that's us.
Very cool. Well, I'd love to nominate the Cascadia region for Brightline and put that on your agenda as well.
It's certainly on the list, right? I mean, I think anywhere where you've got cities that are too long to drive and too short to fly of a certain size and already have kind of pretty strong business and opportunity links, I think you got a great case for high-speed rail. So whether that's Portland and Seattle, Vancouver, I think that region makes a ton of sense to get it done. So who do we need to talk to about getting that done? Can you introduce us with anyone over there?
Yeah. Well, I know that in the Northwest, you know, Washington State has tried to kind of spearhead that with our Governor Inslee, you know, kind of pushing for it. And they're doing like a feasibility study right now, apparently, but it's been going on for a couple of years. And certainly, you know, Seattle is, you know, roughly a 2-hour drive to Vancouver, BC with no traffic and a 3-hour drive to Portland, Oregon with no traffic. And the key there is no traffic because anymore that is really unlikely. And it's exhausting. It's an exhausting drive down I-5. It's kind of a slog. And having taken the train to both cities before, the challenge is just reliability in terms of the schedule. And that's what everyone who does it, who tends to rave about it, but often that's the challenge.
I think that's right. And I think, like, you know, one thing that as I've come to be part of Brightline and understand what really moves the needle for customers, speed's important, but only to a certain degree, right? A lot of what changes behavior is frequency and reliability, and those kind of go hand in hand. So like if you are building high-speed rail that is going 2 or 3 times a day, it's really hard for people to plan their lives around it, right? Especially when compared to air, is that it's easier. Well, it's not easier if it's only going twice a day and like it's at a time I don't need it. So frequency, having it go, I would say at least an hour, and then having that on-time performance be in the high 90% and the 90% level is really what I think is going to move ridership adoption or change user behavior, get people out of their car. So I'm with you there. And I you know, if you think about that 3-hour slog, like that's Miami to Orlando, right? That's could be 3 to 5 hours, right? Depending on the thing. But like, even if, and our train is comparable in time, like it takes about 3 hours, a little more than 3 hours, Miami to Orlando, how much better of an experience is it for you?
Yeah.
Where you can work, you can get up and stretch, you know, you can take calls, you can hang out with you can watch a movie with your family, whatever you're doing. I just think that people are no longer see the car as the vehicle of freedom that it was sold to us as, right? We all want kind of our own freedom of movement and our own freedom of choice. So I'm with you there. Governor Inslee, if you're listening, as I'm sure you are, you know, please reach out. We'd love to make Brian's dream come true of high-speed rail in Cascadia.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Ari, you know, we spoke recently and you made a comment that really struck me when you said something to the effect that your joining Brightline was to help transform it from a transportation company to an e-commerce company. And I would love for you to expand on that.
Yeah. I mean, I think as leaders, we do want to say things that make people think and get a slogan to rally around, right? Brightline is a train company, no matter what wrapping we put on it, we are going to be transporting people. But I do think for the commercial function that I lead, we want to look to some of the other e-commerce brands and companies that are selling products online, like a lot of CPG companies that have done a great job kind of figuring out how to bring people through the top of the funnel, how to make it as frictionless to understand and buy their product. And then also, like, what are the secondary touch points that we're able to bring back and re-engage the customers who either didn't purchase or who are up for a second purchase, or build loyalty through those channels. And I think, like, that's what I'm trying to get Brightline to understand, you know, is like, you know, look, every company sells a ticket or their product online today. But it's a different thing to think like an e-commerce company and think about that user flow behavior and think about those online touch points than it is to think of, you know, your online platform as an extension of your product, right? Those are two different things. So trying to get the team around on that.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's also the digital marketing, the digital engagement, and then moving someone through a purchase funnel, you know, efficiently understanding the options, understanding the benefits, especially for those who are not accustomed to rail. A lot of American consumers, I could see the analogy, and of course, digital first, right? And even intercepting people who are on their phone, you know, in market trying to figure out how to get from A to B.
Well, I think that's right. I think for us, I think there's three principles to, you know, becoming an e-commerce company. One is digital and mobile first, right? We think because we are a transportation company, like, the mobile experience is our best experience. So we want as many of our customers to book through our mobile app. The second thing is that we really want to make sure we are optimizing the purchase funnel. So we, instead of looking at it by channel, right? Oh, these customers came in here, these customers came in here. Let's look at how customers are responding at different stages of the funnel. And then I think lastly, it's about data operations, right? I think if you look at a lot of CPG companies and even online travel companies, they've set up what they call marketing operations, right? Which is data and platforms and KPIs. And so our commercial team now has a commercial operation functions that is able to look at that data holistically, from the prices to the purchase behavior, segmenting our customers, and then leveraging that data for re-engagement on the marketing side and for analysis by, you know, our revenue management team. And so I think it's those kind of three things I think will propel Brightline forward, right? The mobile first, the data, and then the funnel optimization.
Yeah, super interesting. Now, when many of us think about purchasing travel online, you know, many probably think about the online travel aggregators of the world, people like Expedia. I'm curious how Brightline looks at travel aggregators as a way to acquire customers or to be present in journey planning and so forth. How do you look at those, and how do they complement or compete in some ways with your own digital channels?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the same. I don't think Brightline's position is that unique compared to other airline or even hotel places, right? Is that at the end of the day, you want to have a direct relationship with your customer. However, you also have a challenge with awareness and distribution. And especially for a new product like Brightline, like, I want to have the same reach that an Expedia has or that a Kayak has. I just want to make sure that I am, one, if I'm using those distribution channels, I'm still have a direct relationship with my customer. And number two, I'm using it in a way that allows me to manage kind of my average fare and my revenue in the right way. So it, you know, you don't want to overuse those channels. It will dilute you further. People will start booking, making those places your primary point of sale. And I think you always kind of want to make sure that, look, if I can get the awareness that those places are offering me, and if I can get the distribution they're offering me, that's great. But how do I make sure that I'm also not fueling my competitor, right? I'm fueling my partner. So, you know, that I think is kind of our position on it. And look, frankly, we haven't had a reason yet to be on those channels, right? We're going Miami to West Palm. You know, that's really a much shorter segment. But when we open Orlando, we are actively looking at what's the right GDS system for us to be on. How do we connect with airlines? How do we do a bunch of different things? That's where the business really starts to get a level of complexity that's going to be fun and interesting.
Is there an ROI consideration to making yourself available via the GDSs of the world?
I think there is an ROI. I think it is, it's more about how much inventory can you sell through your channels versus how much inventory can you sell through third party channels, right? And if you have to give a commission to those, you're giving that commission in recognition that you couldn't have sold that inventory on your own. So that's when you turn those levers on and off is, you know, okay, hey, it's peak time. I can sell all the inventory on my own channels. I don't have to pay the 10, 15, 20% commission or whatever it might be, versus it's the dog days of summer here in Florida. I need all the help I can get. Who can help me reach more people, right? So yeah. I think that's certainly how we look at it.
It certainly makes sense too, as you open up those segments and where, you know, leisure travelers, tourists, if you will, who are planning vacations to Florida, who may not be familiar, that there's even a train line.
I think that's right. You're hitting on two big awareness challenges for us. Number one is, like, we're a new product in the market, right? So we've got to just like tell people, hey, Brightline's open, Brightline's open, Brightline's open, right? And number two is we have to convince people that the train is going to enhance their experience, right? The train is going to enhance their trip to Florida. And I don't think the general American customer views the train as like, you know, I think they view it as kind of more of a public transportation option, right? And public transit has the right place and that's a need, but we're very different than that. So we've got to drive the behavior changes that we need. We've got two big awareness problems. And I think to your point, like being on Expedia at least helps us solve the first one, right? Like we're here, we're in Florida, we're in Florida, we're in Florida. But in terms of getting that second one, they've got to come to our own channels, right? Only then are they going to see like how wide our seats are, how great our F&B offering is, how beautiful our stations are, and kind of how like, hey, this is actually like going to be a great day with me and my family or me and my friends and whoever it is.
Yeah, actually, you bring up something that I wanted to ask about, which is, you know, what's kind of interesting about this is that you're not only trying to sell a train leg of a journey, but you're also really trying to educate people and change their behaviors and their expectations. Many of them are, you know, many of us here in the United States, of course, are deeply rooted and attached to our cars, and it's a habit. It's our expectation. It's how we think. It's our default mode. Even if we're really frustrated and stressed out by, you know, the prospect of a long, you know, freeway journey and traffic and so on and so forth. And, you know, and certainly you represent a completely different choice for a lot of Americans, especially, and certainly Europeans and others traveling, Latin Americans traveling to Florida, may in some cases have slightly different expectations of train versus car. But certainly for American consumers, you're also really dramatically changing how they think, whether they're a commuter or a leisure traveler. I'm curious how you think about that.
Well, for sure. I mean, our ridership adoption and user behavior change, you know, are all the things that we talk about. And certainly from my experience background in technology, you're always talking about user behavior and user adoption. And I think like, that is exactly it. Like, think about the average American, to your point, like they already know they're getting in their car. They already know they got to go buy gas. They already know that they got to, you know, get in traffic. They know all this stuff and they still do it, right?
Yeah.
because it's right there, you know, it's right there. And we've got to get in their brain. So at least they're being like, well, what about that train? And then like, why aren't I taking that train? And those are like big chasms that we have to cross. And I talk about this a lot with our team is that all the friction in train travel is up front, right? It's or any kind of like mode like that is like, okay, what's the schedule? Where's the station? How do I get there? How do I buy a ticket? Where do I get off? Like all the friction's up front. And then once you get on, it's incredible, right? You're like, you don't think about anything. You're like, great, let me log on. Let me put some music in. Let me take a nap. Like I set my alarm in 1 hour and be at my desk. And it's the easiest thing in the world. The car, on the other hand, is complete opposite, right? All the friction for the car is on the back end. When you're ready to go, keys are in your pocket, your car's in your driveway, you're gone. All the friction now is once you're in the car, right? Like, oh, shoot, I got to get gas. Oh, shoot, I didn't get my oil changed. Oh, there's traffic and I got to pay this toll. Oh, where do I park? All that stuff is on the back end. So we have to get people thinking about the whole journey and not just that first step. And once we get people in their mind thinking about all the steps it takes to get in their car, we become a much more exciting option. But we're not there yet, right? And so we don't have a small task here. It's not a small task, but it's an exciting task, right? And I think like getting, not only do I think getting people to change is something I want to do from a profit motivation standpoint, but there's a whole sustainability part of this, right? That we are operating in Florida, which, you know, is at the forefront of being impacted by climate change. And the faster we can get people into our greener, more sustainable transportation options and out of their cars, hopefully we can have an impact in reducing some of the impacts of climate change to Florida, right? So I think there is also a sustainability piece that is awakening in a lot of American consumer mindset, which we're hoping to tap into.
Yeah, there's just a whole host of benefits. The consumer experience, the sustainability component, right? City center to city center, which as someone who's traveled via train quite a bit in Europe is just like fantastic, right? Because it's one thing to get from airport to airport, but you throw the hassle factor of getting from the airport into wherever you need to get to, or certainly if you're driving, and certainly if you're unfamiliar with the cities and you're driving, it's a whole other level of stress. You take all that off the table, right? And so it's helping people understand that, to your point, right? What can that be like? And yeah.
And I think look, like the airline example is a great example, right? Like
yeah.
They had to convince people to get out of their car and fly. And they had the kind of the same barriers, like, because no one's flying to Miami airport to be at Miami airport, right? You want to right. be at the right? Like no one's flying to Seattle, Tacoma to be between Seattle and Tacoma, right? Like you're going to one of those two other places. And the airlines had to convince people like, hey, get in your car, drive over here, fly then this, and then drive again. And they were able to do it, right? Like they were able to convince people and say, hey, I know if you took your car, you'd be on your own time and your own schedule and you could get from A to B as easy as possible, but we're going to make it easier for you. And I think like that's when you go back, you look at those TWA ads with the T-bone steak and like, you know, everyone flying first class. I think that's how they did it, right? And, you know, Brightline's taking a similar approach to user behavior.
Yeah, all that glamour that they marketed to us in the 60s around plane travel, yeah, it's gone now.
Look at how quick look at how quickly they burned it off. Well, don't worry.
You know, travel, of course, has been one of the sectors of the economy hardest hit by the pandemic, but what are you expecting, certainly here in the U.S., as we start to reopen? What's the mindset of travelers? How quickly do you anticipate we're kind of back, you know, assuming that we're not dealing with like
additional yet variant another or whatever. Yeah, sure, right.
Or whatnot, yeah.
I think this is, a lot of your listeners will be sympathetic to this, but like when I started in February, like the whole focus was on COVID planning and like, how do we convince people that the train is clean and all that stuff. And by April, it was like, don't need that COVID, like all that research you did, like it's going to be better. And now like come June, July, I think we're all forecasting, looking at the numbers, right? Like a lot of 2019 travel, a lot of 2021 travel indicators are at 2019 pre-pandemic levels already. So we're looking at a Q4 that is like, you know, not to be too optimistic, but is looking very strong. And certainly Florida was an animal in two of itself.
Yes.
Throughout the pandemic.
Always is.
Right. We certainly know a lot of our commitment riders have been eagerly awaiting our return. We are eager to get back for them. We are working as hard as we can to reopen by the end of this year to what we think capture is going to be a very exciting holiday season here in Florida, right? Think about, you mentioned you're just out visiting your family. How many people didn't see their family for the past year? How many people is this going to be the first Christmas that they're able to get back together, right? And I think that's just going to drive a lot of consumer spending on travel. So we're bullish on what Q4 looks like, and we're trying to get open to capture some of that.
Yeah, having done some business travel recently, as well as traveling just this past week to visit some family, it's evident in the airports, certainly, just how many very, very young children are traveling with, to go visit grandparents or vice versa. And you can just see the pent-up demand, certainly amongst leisure travelers to do just that. And I do expect certainly the sunshine of Florida will be a big appeal.
Very appealing.
Late fall and winter and people wanting to visit family and so forth. I think that'll be very interesting to see. And I think if anything, we're probably going to go speeding past 2019 levels based on the pent-up demand.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think the one thing that we're trying to triangulate is a little bit of business forecast. What's the lag there, right? So, Florida does a ton of conferences. out here, and how quickly are those businesses going to spin back up and do sales offsites and things like that to drive some of the other decisions. So I think like that is kind of where kind of the only thing that's still kind of outstanding for us. And we're talking to a lot of people in the business travel space to see how quickly these businesses are trying to get back on the road.
Yeah, I think business travel will be different than it was pre-pandemic, right? But you know, certainly customers.
Why do you think that? Why do you think it's going to be different?
Well, I just feel that there may be a type of business travel that is off the table a bit. I think there was probably, we've all learned now that there's a certain kind of meeting, there's a certain kind of sync up, a certain kind of discussion with a customer or whatnot that works perfectly fine over Zoom. You don't, though, necessarily build the kind of relationships that you can with offline, you know, get-togethers and interactions and socializing. And so I think that we may see that business travel does not return to pre-pandemic levels, but it's not going to crash. I mean, it's definitely coming back, but I think it will change. And yet at the same time, we're going to have a lot more employees working remote and companies wanting to have periodic, you know, meetups again to create some fabric of relationships inside the company. And that might happen quarterly or even monthly. And so that might actually make up for that. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah. I think like it's going to be interesting, the business piece. I know there was a big remote adoption, right? And I think there's still the desire for most employees to have more autonomy of where they do their work. And I think that is kind of the key. But I think there's a big segment of the population that just found, look, all in the office was not good and all remote was not good. And so how do I get into the office 2 or 3 days a week, make that time productive, make that time helpful to me? And so, you know, there's a phrase we use called facts, not yet in evidence. And I think like that is an eager one. We're waiting to see the evidence. We're waiting to see kind of what people are really going to do versus what they've been saying.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I've, of course, been involved in digital now for, you know, quite a long time and, you know, have also worked remote for quite a long time, although I always paired it with a fair bit of travel. But just recently, getting together with key team members of mine in person or other parts of the organization in person with a couple of different trips, including meeting people who I've been working with now for quite some time that I'd never met in person before, it's quite clear the benefits of getting together in person. I'll just say it. You know, it's like it was evident to me right away. Like, oh, this is what we've been missing. The types of communication, the pace of discussion and ideation and creativity. Now, and developing trust, right? Getting to know each other and making connections across functional areas, really hard to do in a remote Zoom-based type of work style. And yet, I think most people also agree that they don't necessarily... they're not going to be more productive, actually, if they're in the office every day. It's some blend of the two. And I think even each organization might find their own kind of balance with that. We'll have to see.
Yeah. I'll give you a good example. So I started at Brightline February 1st, right? In the middle of the pandemic. I didn't actually meet most of my team till April. And I will tell you, like, as a new employee, new leader, like, it was hard to, like, build trust and, you know, pick up on a lot of the soft signals and like generate the buy-in that I was looking for, you know, because it's hard to do that via email and text and a couple of Zooms here and there. And like the moment we got together, like after a week or two, you know, you just have a little more of a rapport. We were able to build trust, like how quickly we could knock out certain ideas in a room. Like there's just that value. I think there are some people and some teams that have done a really good job replicating that, but for me, it was hard. I couldn't see how to do that. Right. And I think for Brightline, it's ramping up right now to get ready, you know, hiring a couple hundred people. I don't know how we would do that if we were all virtual. Right. I think that'd be really hard.
Yeah. Yeah. And we'll take the train to get there. Yeah.
take the train for all reasons, exactly. Work, whatever it is.
Now, prior to joining Brightline, you had founded a successful social media marketing engagement platform in the hospitality industry, and you've been kind of working on this combining of physical and digital experience for some time. And I guess I'm just kind of interested in how you think about blending sort of the physical experience with the digital experience when you think of something like Brightline. And what are some of the things that you envision being important for the consumer, for the traveler, as they do that?
That's a great, great question. So, you know, look, we do think about the experience holistically, right? Like, we are an experience-driven company. The onboard experience is really important to us. The in-station experience is really important to us. And we want that same level of kind of service and frictionless environment to be present on digital, right? And so this is going beyond kind of the buying purchase, but like, how do we enable a great experience in the train and in the station, you know, through your phone? So one, you know, we want to make sure that all the amenities we have at the station, you should be able to access those just as easy as you can your ticket, which is on your phone. So how can you order food ahead of time to be picked up? Or how can you pre-order food for the train, right? On a 30-minute corridor or 60-minute corridor, it's not as important. But as we do that three-hour thing, now it becomes pretty important, right? Similarly, you know, how can we, so the other thing we are actively thinking about is how can we reduce redundant travel for you, right? And when I mean redundant travel, I mean like going to get your dry cleaning, right? Or going to the grocery store, right? Like you're with us for an hour, 2 hours a day. How could we enable some of these things to be available in our stations, right? So you could take one less car trip. And we think that now becomes a platform that allows us to enable a lot of your lifestyle, right? Like a lot of your mobility. So, you know, I'm answering your question like a little bit holistically and not on the point by point, but like I would say for us, when I ran BCV, one of the things that we were really excited to do was be able to deliver real-time guest intelligence to the hotel so that they could enable a better service and a more personalized service. With Brightline, we already plan to know a lot about the guest and the hotel, and certainly we'll augment that with social. But now, based on what we know and based on what your needs are, how can we deliver a better personalized service offering using, I would call it, a nexus of amenities that are owned, like our own F&B, or our partner, like a dry cleaning or an Instacart or something like that. So that's kind of how we're thinking about it.
Yeah, and that experience will come together in a digital way as well, just to drive convenience and even awareness for the consumer to access all those different services.
Yeah, exactly. And I think using that digital access point is the right way to think about it, you know?
So transportation's come a long ways in terms of commerce, making it easier for customers to buy tickets, get onto trains, planes, et cetera, become relatively frictionless. But I am kind of curious, you know, are there new models that you're thinking about with respect to ticketing, passes, subscriptions, to really change even the model that we think about when we think about something like a train ticket?
Yeah, I think that's a great question as well. So we want to offer what we think are the right set of products for the customer, whether it's a single round trip, but we also want to have a monthly pass that you can level up to a 2 month pass, 3 month pass, or an annual pass based on, you know, your needs and see corresponding value with the commitment that you're giving to us. But then we also, out of COVID, kind of thought, well, people aren't going to be going back 5 days a week, or if they aren't, how do they get more flexibility? They still want to make a commitment to Brightline, but they don't know if that monthly pass is worth it. So we wanted to do 10 packs in the same way that you can bundle those. So you can go on and buy 5 10 packs, which is essentially a 50 pack, or buy 3 10 packs. We wanted to make those super flexible, right? So like, not only can Brian buy a 10 pack, but like Brian can buy a 10 pack and give 2 of those rides to his wife or 3 of her rides to his daughter, right? So like, it enables both a kind of a family pass and just a lot more flexibility while being able to lock in your price. We really like that product. The last product that we're not committed to offering yet, but are still really exploring. So a little sneak preview here to your audience here. Part of our desire to look at the best of the e-commerce companies was how can we build a subscription model, you know, and like, is there a right subscription model that is, that, and who's it for? What's the right use case? Who's the right customer? So, you know, if you paid like $199 per year and you were able to get exclusive access to certain events around and in the Brightline area, if you were able to kind of have a certain amount of complimentary upgrades and you were able to lock in your price point, would that be something you'd want to do? Or are we just like desperately reaching out to like the hottest trends in e-commerce and trying to bolt it on to a train company, and that just doesn't make sense? So, I mean, we are, you know, what do you, I would turn it to you, Brian, as an expert, is like, what do you think about a subscription plan for a train company?
Well, I would look at it really from the lens of, as a consumer, you know, from my standpoint, I think priority and is sort of, and maybe status in this sense, is kind of where the subscription would really be appealing. I love the idea, by the way, of being able to share my pack with others. I love that idea. But also, I think for Brightline, drives trial. You know, the more people are doing that, the more people are trying out the train. But in terms of a subscription, I would say priority and kind of status are probably what's going to make me feel like that's really worth it, right? Yes, my price is locked in, or I've got some, you know, number of trips that are included in the subscription where I don't really have to think too much about it. But even more importantly, when I arrive at the station, when I board the train, you know, I feel like I am, you know, gaining some benefit. So the seats that I have, or the status, or the experience on the train with, you know, my favorite beverage and all this stuff preloaded, because you know who I am.
Yeah, that's a good idea. You know, I like that idea of priority and loyalty. So we're also, you know, going to be launching a loyalty program, so the subscription buyers could get into a higher loyalty tier. Maybe gives them access to the lounge regardless of what class they bought. So I think there is benefits that we could derive from it. We obviously want to make sure that there's enough of a market for this and that this works out. Because I think what I really want to build at Brightline from a brand perspective is that it's more of a cult, right? Like, people are taking Brightline. They love it. They're advocates of it. They talk to their friends about it. They're like, you, they're buying a 10 pack and they're like, hey, you got to ride with me. Like, you know, here's a ticket. Come ride the train with me to wherever we're going. And if we can get more of that activated through a subscription model, it's like, whoa, I'm an original Brightline member, right? Or whatever it might be. That is something that I think has, you know, a really good kind of quantifiable value that we could put on it. So I, you know, it's something we're really looking at. Obviously, we're chewing on a lot already, just trying to get open by Q4, but, you know, it's certainly on our list.
Yeah. I mean, I just think about, you know, my airline status. The thing I love about it the most, it's boarding first. Let's just be honest. No matter where I'm sitting on the plane, it just removes the hassle factor
right
off the table. Lounge access through partners and whatever. That's really nice. You know, sort of the last thing I think about is the mileage and using the map.
Really? Okay. Isn't that
funny?
Interesting.
Yeah, that's just me. But, you know, it's more about I'm earning the right to travel more comfortably with less stress.
More of a convenience.
That's what, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's pretty good. You know, we're also, you know, the other part of Brightline that is, we might maybe include in the subscription is we're really thinking about first and last mile as part of our train service. So, you know, possibly if you're a subscription member, you get access to our fleet of shuttles on demand, right?
I think that's golden.
Yeah.
That really changes the game.
Because it goes back to your convenience thing, right? It allows me to travel more convenient, more comfortably. So what wouldn't you pay to give that? If you know you're going to take Brightline and you know always like your last mile is always taken care of as part of your ticket, why wouldn't you do that?
Yeah, absolutely. That makes a lot of sense to me. Barry, I want to thank you so much for your time today. Time for our standard last question on the podcast.
Yeah. Okay.
What futuristic digital commerce innovation are you most looking forward to becoming a reality? Or alternatively, what innovation do you think is just really overhyped and you think is just going to be a ridiculous failure? And the only reason why we keep hearing about it is it's just clickbait.
Yeah. I mean, for me, that the one that I like just routinely roll my eyes about is voice, right? Like with Alexa and all that stuff. And like, I get it. Like, I've had them in the house. Like, I think they're fun, but like, I think the adoption, like, you know, you always see the great articles like 5,000% more searches. It's like, well, because there was like 100 last week and now there's 500, right? So like, you know, like you still have a meaningful amount of voice related search. And I think that is like something that like when other products or invest in that, I kind of say like, listen, let's just make these channels that we have. Like, I don't think we need a voice related channel, but you know, how long has Siri been around? How long have all these things been around? I just don't think you're seeing the adoption there that's going to move it over. On the other hand, look at how long QR codes have been around, and now with the global pandemic, they're working, right? I remember we used to do as part of our social, a part of my company, we always wanted to have a QR code extension, and we always had it there, and people always were really excited to buy it. Nobody used it. And now it's like, you go everywhere, the QR code, everyone knows how to do it. My parents know how to do it. So that, you know, that I guess I'm excited to see that has actually taken off. But I would say the larger trend that I feel is making commerce more personalized, more accessible is just kind of API and headless commerce, right? Like, you know, the more channels that we can create by connecting with different platforms through various APIs that can securely retain your information, right? Like some of the new applications to faster checkout or to make that more permissive across the web, I think are home runs, right? Because I think everyone's always getting in a situation where they want to be in a one click, they're on their phone, they're like, wait, why hasn't this remembered me? You're like, wait, why hasn't this done that? And you don't want to have to do that. So the thing that I roll my eyes at is voice. The thing that I'm excited about is QR codes. The thing that I'm excited about for the future is more API connected and permissive checkout. So those would be my standards.
Those are great. I tend to be a bit of a voice skeptic as well.
Good.
When the killer app is setting a timer, I just don't think we've quite hit. I don't think we've quite hit.
Alexa, remind me when this podcast starts, right? all the listeners should do that, though. All those listeners should remind themselves, right? You should set that. Yeah.
Indeed. And I also don't like it when I'm over at a friend's house and the way they change the music is by shouting across the room at Alexa. And I'm like, okay, you know, I think it's a lot more discreet if I'm typing into my phone to change the music on the Sonos, right? Anyway. But at any rate, but I also think it's a bit of a chicken and the egg. And I think there are some really valuable use cases. Some of our customers are using, you know, voice-based search. Those are more in the B2B sector. So you can imagine a technician or a carpenter, a plumber who, you know, fumbling around at their phone when they've got gloves on and they're kind of like hands are in a job, right? And hands-free suddenly becomes much more valuable and a much more high utility kind of interface for a B2B segment.
Yeah, you haven't sold me. That doesn't sell me on it. I still feel like the plumber is buying most of their stuff with their fingers and not their voice.
Well, they probably are.
Yeah.
They probably are today. But I think there are applications like that where you can say, okay, but that isn't going to drive mass adoption. That is for sure. And obviously hands-free in the car and so forth. But again, that's a relatively small use case relative to what we're doing through text. And of course, fully agree with you on the advantages of headless to drive all those various touch points that, you know, businesses like yours, you need to implement, right? Everything from the mobile apps to the web to in-station kiosks on the train, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You want to obviously leverage one infrastructure to do that. And now you can much more easily than ever before.
That's great. Yeah. I mean, I think we're excited about that. And, you know, looking forward to testing all this on hundreds of customers like yourself that will walk through those doors in October, including all of your listeners. So thank you.
Well, I'll try to make that long journey from Seattle to Florida. Unfortunately, I'll have to fly to get there.
You will.
To use the train.
But, you know, by the time, you know, you fly 2023, fly into Orlando and plan to go to Miami, or plan to Miami, go to Orlando. So, you know, we're ready.
Sounds good. Well, Ari, thank you so much again for taking the time to share the Brightline story with us, and always interesting and great to reconnect with you again. And thanks so much.
Yeah. Hey, thanks. This was a lot of fun. I appreciate your input and excited to be part of the community.
All right. Wonderful. And to all of you out there, thank you so much for listening. Be safe, be well. Here's to good business.
The State of Commerce Experience podcast is brought to you by Bloomreach, the leader in digital commerce experience. Bloomreach provides solutions for leading businesses all across the world to both drive increased revenue and also to help them personalize the shopping experience for their customers across all of their digital channels. If you'd like to find out more, please visit bloomreach.com.